At the very beginning of The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy rides her bike around a sepia-toned Kansas in braids and a gingham dress. Her Auntie Em, who's busy working on the farm, tells Dorothy to go find a place where she won't get into any trouble.
Do you suppose there is such a place, Toto?
There must be. It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon, beyond the rain.
And then, in a classic case of be careful what you wish for, a twister. We all know what happens next. Dorothy's swept up in a twister, and she lands in a technicolor world filled with yellow brick roads and ruby slippers.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Those words have branded the state of Kansas in the eyes of the world since 1939. If you've traveled and told people you're from Kansas or even Kansas City, you've probably been asked about Toto at some point or another. So if this movie defines us, what exactly does it say? And do we believe it? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard on KCUR is a Screen Time episode all about The Wizard of Oz. Call 816-235-2888 to share your theory. Why do lines from this movie still reverberate in Kansas almost 80 years after its release? Is it the politics, the psychology, the landscape? 816-235-2888. I have a great panel in the studio this morning. First, Russ Simmons is our resident film critic. Welcome to the show, Russ.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Start us off with a few basic facts about The Wizard of Oz, the making of the movie, its popularity since.
The movie actually was probably the sixth adaptation. There had been several silent versions. There had been some animated shorts.
And, of a book series.
Yes, that's right. And also had a hit Broadway musical version as well. And that inspired the 1939 version. And I think, in my mind, it's stuck in the subconscious of our nation because of its repeated TV viewings. It started annual viewings in 1956. And since it already strikes a chord with the child in all of us and it became so popular, those lines will still reverberate because we hear them year after year after year after year.
Why do you think that it strikes a nerve with the child in all of us?
There's some kind of primal fears that children have that this movie plays right into, but there's also a salvation that comes at the end, and that is so reassuring to children that I think that's why it appeals obviously to all audiences. But first of all, it's enormously entertaining and involving, but because it also has that component, it really brings us in and makes us a part of it.
What's interesting is that the salvation is really, when you think about it, just a shift in Dorothy's own attitude toward Kansas.
True enough. And, you know, like she says, there's no place like home. And she comes to accept that and realize that she had what she wanted was really at home all the time. Just like in It's a Wonderful Life, you know, George Bailey wanted to go out and see the world. But when he realized his happiness was right at home, then that's when he truly understood his purpose there.
This has such staying power, and we'll get to this in a moment with our other guest, in terms of spin-offs and adaptations and even just subtle references. Have you seen the new Pee Wee Herman movie yet?
I have not.
Okay, because there's at the very beginning, there's a little nod to The Wizard of Oz where he goes through a series of saying, "I'll never leave home, I'll never leave home," which in some ways could be interpreted as the message of this movie.
You're right. And, you know, that's the criticism that it's gotten, as well as I brought up It's a Wonderful Life. Oh, poor George Bailey, he's never fulfilled himself because he's got stuck at home. And the same thing with Dorothy. If she's not going to be fulfilled unless she goes out into the world. But that's one point of view, which is valid. But the other side of it is, hey, their happiness is at home, so they should stay home.
The scenes depicting Kansas are sepia-toned, as I mentioned, and right. The rest of the movie in Oz is technicolor, which isn't exactly like a flattering way of showcasing Kansas. What do you know about that decision?
Actually, you know, Baum describes Kansas as gray and...
That's L. Frank Baum, the author of the books.
Correct, correct. And so there was a 1936 animated short that first did that, that came up with the idea of showing Kansas in black and white and then shifting over to color when she goes to Oz. And they borrowed that idea when they did the movie. And it's just for that reason to indicate that it's a dull gray landscape that she's in that she wants to escape and go to someplace colorful.
Well, dang. we've got Clint Stevie with us, and he's the director, the executive director of the Columbia Theater in Wamego, Kansas, which oversees the Oz Museum there. And I want to get his take on this. Hi, Clint.
Morning.
So you get visitors from all over the world, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And Wamego's not exactly to reach. It's tucked away in the hilly part of Kansas near Manhattan, not how Kansas is portrayed in this movie. What brings international visitors to the Oz Museum, and how do they tend to react to the real Kansas after having been exposed to the Wizard of Oz Kansas?
I think for many of our travelers, international and just from the States, pleasantly surprised by their experience in Kansas, you know, especially when they're making their way to Wamego. You know, they're driving through the picturesque Flint Hills. There are hills. It's, you know, if they were driving through right now, they would be seeing all the fields burning, which is pretty dynamic. And they're probably wondering, why are we allowing people to just allow fires go crazy across the landscape?
Yeah, the annual prairie burns.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a really exciting component that many of our travelers don't get to see. And then, you know, after that, you follow up with this bright green grass that is not in any description found in L. Frank Baum's book or any of the interpretations in film. So,
yeah, do people, I mean, on some subconscious level, kind of expect it to be black and white here?
I think they have a very dreary conception of what Kansas is. I think it is, for most of them, prior to their actual experience of our state, is that it's flat. The grass is withered and dying and just kind of there. It's super dry.
That lots of dirt.
Yeah, lots of dirt.
Chickens everywhere. When watching this movie again, there are just random chickens all over the place in Kansas.
Yes.
Well, so, but they do, these people who expect Kansas to be dreary are still making quite a pilgrimage to be here. Why?
Well, I think that, you know, that a lot of those points have been hit on. But, you know, this is a film that's been the most viewed film of all time. And it's, there's a lot of modern parallels to showcase the popularity of the Oz genre. So, the books, when they came out, were on par with Harry Potter in popularity. And through 1900 to 1963, you could almost expect an Oz book to come out annually. And then all the showings. By 1988, I think the film had been shown 30 times on television, which at that time was a remarkable milestone. So, you know, it is the film has aged so well with the different evolutions in technology, and so it's moved up. So, you know, you come out with home video, and then it just skyrockets through that, selling almost $300 million of VHS alone. So it's just always been there and catapulted along with technology. So it's just so available, and everybody's had that experience with The Wizard of Oz. So, you know, it's a part of our culture, and I think because the accessibility has been so great, it's often taken for granted.
Well, there's also, you know, let's go back to 1939. I know none of us were there, but like in 1939, you compared this to the Harry Potter series as far as the books go. But I think, just when I think about it, a big difference would be that now we kind of expect popular books to get made into movies. It's a typical thing. I don't know if that was the case in 1939, that you could just expect to see your favorite characters come to life on screen.
No, I would agree with that. And also, we're talking about 39 years after the original book came out. So there was a long wait. There were some interpretations on film prior to, but to truly do, to make a film that could showcase the magic involved in adventure and innocence of childhood was a large feat and a very expensive feat, which MGM was really probably the only studio at the time that could really fully realize that potential of the story. And they did that knowing it was going to be a showcase piece. I don't think they had any intentions of trying to make a large profit off the film. I think it was a break-even movie for them to kind of highlight the greatness of MGM.
Huh. Well, so I want to get back to this question. So we this is great. We understand now how much of an influence this movie has had on so many people, and that some viewers, it's been translated into more than 40 languages, that viewers, it's not just generations of viewers, it's nations of viewers, and that people come from all over the place in order to touch down, I guess, with their Oz experience. There's the physical landscape that this movie, The Wizard of Oz, portrays in Kansas, but there's also a personality. I mean, you've got Dorothy, who, even by the standards of Oz, is this sort of naive, saccharine, sweet, highly principled little girl. And then you've got her family, this salt of the earth, hardworking clan of people who, you know, every scene you see with them, they are doing physical labor and can't be interrupted. Do people expect Kansans to be a certain way?
I think that, you know, interacting with our visitors to the museum, that their expectation of Kansans, which are, I feel, are oftentimes met, is that we're hardworking people who are very, very nice. So, so they're expecting from the museum, for example, a great customer service and, you know, I suppose a hardworking people who are willing to do what it takes to get the job done.
You're in a nice suit. Do they? I mean, not sorry. I use suit kind of loosely. You're in a blazer and a nice shirt, like you're a nicely dressed guy. Are they expecting you to be in overalls?
Probably at least gingham.
Let's hear a theory from Paul in Kansas City when it comes to The Wizard of Oz. He called 816-235-2888. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Maybe it's because I grew up here, you know, and I've seen the movie probably several times over.
And when you say here, you mean in Kansas City?
Yeah, and I mean, I grew up on the Missouri side, and I'm wondering, am I the only one that gets this surreal analogy in my head that, you know, the tornado carried her away, and I mean, Oz isn't a real place, but, you know, she's in this strange land, and it's like, did she end up on the Missouri side? 'Cause, I mean, between the two states, they're very different, even culturally, but Missouri just seems so much more diverse and colorful than the Kansas side. Am I the only one that just kind of gets this weird idea there?
Of Missouri as Oz?
Yes.
Well,
I don't know where that comes from. Like I said, I grew up here. Maybe, I don't know, but...
Does Oz seem like it has an urban center to you, maybe, with like the Emerald City?
Right.
And so something like St. Louis?
Or to take, correct.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, again, fairly unflattering idea about Kansas built into that, but what do you guys think? I've never heard that one before, but kudos, Paul, on an original theory.
I would say that my friends who went to MU would definitely agree with that theory. Everything Missouri is superior to everything Kansas, and so they would find that enormously appealing, I think.
Well, so the movie The Wizard of Oz, we've mentioned it before, it's based on a series of books that was really popular at the time. And the series, it's been said that it's really kind of an allegory for political and economic ideas. Clint, is that something that people are interested in when they come to the Oz Museum?
You know, we do experience that question quite a bit. Elfrink Baum, which we have a lot of communication with the family and the resources that they have, never had any intentions of being political with this story. His intention was entirely to connect with children, to provide a story for children that hopefully reduced the fears that were present in the world to a manageable level for the youth. And the theory around the political portions actually was came along later. Instructor used the Oz as a way of a teaching mechanism. And so he did such a great job that it's now largely identified with the original story.
Well, I want to play two clips, one from the opening scenes in Kansas and one that takes place in Oz. The power dynamics in these two scenes are very different. In the first scene, a mean rich lady named Elmira Gulch has been bitten by Dorothy's dog. Elmira's just arrived at the farm to threaten Auntie Em and Uncle Henry, who are poor farmers.
I want to see you and your wife right away about Dorothy.
Dorothy? Well, what has Dorothy done?
What's she done? I'm all but lame from the bite on my leg.
You mean she bit you?
No, her dog.
Oh, she bit her dog, eh?
No. That dog's a menace to the community. I'm taking him to the sheriff and make sure he's destroyed.
Destroyed? Toto? Oh, you can't. You mustn't. Auntie Em, Uncle Henry, you won't let her, will you?
Of course we won't. Will we, Em?
Please, Aunt Em. Toto didn't mean to. He didn't know he was doing anything wrong. I'm the one that ought to be punished. I let him go in her garden. You can send me to bed without supper.
If you don't hand over that dog, I'll bring a damn suit and take your whole farm. There's a law protecting folks against dogs that bite. How would it be if she keeps him tied up? He's really gentle. With gentle people, that is. Well, that's for the sheriff to decide. Here's his order, allowing me to take it. Unless you want to go against the law. We can't go against the law, Dorothy. I'm afraid poor Toto will have to go. Now you're seeing reason. Here's what I'm taking him in. So he can't attack me again.
Oh, no, no, I won't let you take him. You go away. Oh, I'll bite you myself.
Dorothy.
You wicked old witch. Uncle Henry, Auntie Em, don't let him take you.
Oh,
don't let him take him, please. Stop her.
Put him in the basket, Henry.
Oh,
I did.
No, Henry. Oh, Toto.
Elmira Gulch, just because you own half the county doesn't mean you have the power to run the rest of us. For 23 years, I've been dying to tell you what I thought of you. And now, well, being a Christian woman, I can't say it.
Elmira Gulch owns half the county, and poor Auntie Em and Uncle Henry have their hands tied with the idea of a lawsuit. They're going to have to take Dorothy's dog from her. Now let's hear what happens when Dorothy encounters the Wicked Witch of the West in Oz. The Wicked Witch bears an uncanny resemblance to Elmira Gulch, and Dorothy's protector this time isn't Auntie Em, but Glenda the Good Witch. In this scene, the ruby slippers have just landed on Dorothy's feet, and the Wicked Witch wants them back.
Give me back my slippers. I'm the only one that knows how to use them. They're no use to you. Give them back to me. Give them back.
Keep tight inside of them. Their magic must be very powerful, or she wouldn't want them so badly.
You stay out of this, Glinda, or I'll fix you as well.
Oh, rubbish. You have no power here. Be gone.
So these are two very different ideas about power, one associated with Kansas and one with Oz. And I'm curious about what people in this room and out in our listenership think about whether that idea of power in Kansas sticks with us today, the idea that Kansas is full of good working class folks being oppressed by some real meanies, if you don't mind my saying so, with the ability to just crush them because of greater capital, greater resources, what have you. Is that what you guys pick up in these kind of two scenes?
I can certainly see that. I don't know. It was mentioned that Baum's initial intent wasn't political particularly, but it was my understanding, and perhaps you can correct me, that the Scarecrow was representative of Kansas farmers and that that they had to get a brain in order to meet the challenges that they had faced. Am I off base on that?
That's actually part of the lesson that that instructor used to teach. So so that wasn't part of Baum's original intention. That was the teaching mechanism that the instructor, when he was using the Wizard of Oz as an instructing method. So,
well, actually, there's a great clip that we happen to have, and I think we should give it a listen. It involves this idea of getting a brain, and it's from later in the movie when, you know, I'm guessing people have seen it, but the, you know, Dorothy and the Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Lion, they all have something they need. They're going down the yellow brick road. They're facing all sorts of dangers, including flying monkeys, with the idea that the wizard can give them what they need. And then it turns out, spoiler, he kind of can't. But here's what happens when the Wizard of Oz is confronted on this brain issue on behalf of the Scarecrow.
Why, anybody can have a brain. That's a very mediocre commodity. Every pusillanimous creature that crawls on the earth or slinks through slimy seas has a brain. Back where I come from, we have universities, seats of great learning, where men go to become great thinkers. And when they come out, they think deep thoughts, and with no more brains than you have. But they have one thing you haven't got, a diploma. Therefore, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Universitatis Comitiatum e Pluribus Unum, I hereby confer upon you the honorary degree of Ph.D.
Ph.D.?
Yeah, that's Doctor of Thinkology.
Sum of the square roots of any two sides of an isosceles triangle is equal to the square root of the remaining side. Oh, George, Rachel, I've got a brain! How can I ever thank you enough?
Well, you can't.
But, okay, so that's, if, let's just pretend this theory is real, that the Scarecrow represents Kansans, this is actually kind of a validation, maybe, of an idea that what others have, and maybe other parts of the country, if we even believe this breakdown of, like, the poor Kansas farmer who needs either a brain or more education, which that is a pretty contentious idea in the first place. But if that's the idea there is some sort of argument built into that scene that...
I think that's always been my interpretation of it. All of these characters, they already have what they're looking for. They just need to use it. And that's the lesson, is that, yes, you've got a brain, so use it.
We'll hear what Oz might tell us about power and tornadoes when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to our Screen Time series. Don't go away. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard, where we're looking at The Wizard of Oz through a prism. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been talking with film critic Russ Simmons and the Oz Museum's Clint Stevie. We have one more panelist in the room, and I'm eager to get to him because the movie starts with a tornado. It's the weather event that sets the whole plot into motion. Without a tornado, Dorothy never leaves Kansas, never reaches Oz. Steve Bean is the technology coordinator for Kansas City's Office of Emergency Management. We talked to him last tornado season because he's the one who decides whether to sound the sirens during the storm. Steve Bean, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Do you think Hollywood portrayals of tornadoes, or twisters, as they call them in The Wizard of Oz, do you think that those have affected how people understand not just these storms, but how they think about this part of the country?
Oh, I think absolutely. I get calls somewhat routinely from people being transferred here from California, and they've been transferred to Kansas, and they're worried about tornadoes. And I always get a chuckle because they come from the land of landslides and and wildfires and earthquakes and every imaginable disaster, and they come here and they're scared of tornadoes.
In The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy is out on her bike being a little bit contrarian with her elders when the wind starts picking up. And the only signal that there's a funnel cloud to the larger community is a bunch of people running around saying, "A twister, a twister." And today, that is not how the message gets out. But in 1939, is that how things really would have gone down?
Well, largely. In fact, 1939, the FCC prohibited anybody from talking about tornadoes over the radio until it was after the fact. There was a lot of concern about panic from 1898, something like that, to 1938. They were banned from predicting tornadoes and because of the fear. One of the trial examples was in Wichita. They actually successfully predicted a tornado, issued a warning, and the business leaders cried out and demanded that they stop because of the impact on business.
And do I remember right that you were at one time a police officer in the era where you had to drive around and like ride up and down the streets letting people know there were tornadoes?
Well,
isn't it so far from a twister, a twister?
In the early days of my career, one of the things we did during a tornado warning was, besides the sirens, yes, we drove around in our police cars and shouted it out on our sirens. And it was a little embarrassing at the time.
But do you think that I don't know. There's this picture of panic in The Wizard of Oz that I kind of associate with that method of message delivery. Did you encounter panic when you were driving around doing that? Or were people just sort of like, whatever?
No, I think they did a lot of what they still do. They come out to see what all the commotion was about. Back then, they weren't filming things to put on YouTube. But in 1939, there had been a couple of pretty significant historical tornadoes. 1925 was the deadliest ever. So people would have been aware but had a lot of fear because they didn't really understand what they were about. They just knew what they were.
I want to get into the science of tornadoes and how it compares with the storm we see in Wizard of Oz, but we're going to start by hearing how Dorothy describes what's happened. She's describing it to the Munchkins in Oz. Glenda the Good Witch thinks that Dorothy fell from a star and has introduced Dorothy that way, so Dorothy's got a few things to set straight.
She fell from the sky, she fell very far, and Kansas, she says, is the name of the star.
Kansas, she says, is the name of the star.
She brings you good news, or haven't you heard, when she fell out of Kansas, a miracle occurred.
Was no miracle. What happened was just this. The wind began to switch, the house to pitch, and suddenly the hinges started to unhitch. Just then, the witch, to satisfy an itch, went flying on her broomstick, thumbing for a hitch.
And oh, what happened then was rich.
The house began to pitch, and the kitchen took a hitch. It landed on the wicked witch in the middle of a ditch.
Okay, so obviously there are some parts of this involving witches and ditches that are not scientific. But what about her description of how she experienced the storm itself? Like, I have not been in a house that was affected by a tornado. This description of the hinges unhitching and all of that, is that what happens? They pitch and unhitch? Or does that just happen to rhyme?
Yeah, I think it happened to rhyme. I don't know that anybody's ever put being in a tornado to song. Yeah, I mean, you hear the typical expression is the freight train. You'll hear the train. I have heard the train one time. I was close enough. I can't say that my house was pitching, but my house never landed on a witch either. So.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. That seems to have caused her a lot of trouble. Well, so this movie really scared me when I was a kid, and it specifically was the tornado that scared me. Supposedly, people from around here aren't scared of tornadoes. That I've heard that that's sort of an out-of-towner's fear, but I really was terrified by them. And I totally blame this tornado scene for the fact that for a period of my youth, the flushing of a toilet was too similar to a tornado. So I had to stand really far away, be ready to open the door, and then like run as I flushed for a long time. This is the fault of The Wizard of Oz, I believe. So I want to get all of our panelists in on what is scary about this. Russ, what is it about the way this scene is filmed and edited that makes it so scary?
Well, It's really brilliantly done, particularly for 1939, which is long before CG and all of that, but because it was a mechanical tornado that they constructed, and it spun, and it was made out of cotton and all kinds of things, you know, and muslin. But it looks so real. Even today, you look at that and you think, that those special effects stand up. They're high quality. And it's dark. It's already dark and gray. But when you see this thing coming and you know what its potential is, yeah, that can really get it to be a pretty unnerving.
And Clint, I mean, a lot of people find this movie incredibly scary, but for different reasons. I mean, it seems like everyone latches on to a different thing about The Wizard of Oz that's this is what's really scary about it. Based on your encounters with visitors to the Oz Museum, does it tend to be because of the tornadoes or something else? What are some of the common ones you hear?
I think with the tornadoes, it's mostly fascination and hopes that they're not going to be still in Kansas when one comes around. I think that most of the people who talk to me about their fears in relation to The Wizard of Oz, it's about the flying monkeys and the Wicked Witch. And I've always thought it was funny that the Wicked Witch has had such a big impression on people, and she's only in the film for around 13 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
She does make a large enough impression that you feel like she's more present.
Yes, absolutely.
Are you able to make any sweeping generalizations? I generally avoid those, but I'm interested about what kinds of people are scared of which kinds of things in The Wizard of Oz.
You know, I wish I could, but I've been surprised numerous times. We had a piece that we were getting framed that showcased some flying monkeys, and the framer was probably in his 60s, and he refused to frame it because he was still terrified of the flying monkeys.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Was this a guy who you would have pegged for being a little on the anxious side or just a regular guy?
First glance, I would have guessed he was not afraid of anything.
Well, Steve, what is your sense of what's scary about tornadoes? As someone who can't just tune out what's going on out there when there is a storm system in our area.
I think the sense of helplessness about it. I mean, most people around here, if we've done our job right, have a plan. And hopefully at least today are starting to think, where will I go if this happens? But beyond hiding, which is against the nature for a lot of people, beyond taking cover and hiding, there's really not a lot to do. So there's that sense of helplessness that everything is out of my control, because people today really want to have that. And the other thing is just the lack of information. You know, back each year we get closer and closer to saying more specifically what area is threatened. Used to be it was the whole county. Now we get down to neighborhoods. But there's anxiousness for your loved ones, for people that are going on, and there's kind of a black hole of information that's really scary. Is, you know, how are my loved ones? Because the lines are backed up. I've got family in Oklahoma City, and it's really difficult to not know what's going on.
Do you think there's something also that happens in news coverage after a tornado? Often my impression will be that, you know, there will be one block that was just totally devastated, and then the next block, everything is fine. That, or that kind of sense that there's like almost, I mean, it's hard to look at the way tornadoes play out and not get sort of this feeling that there was, that the tornado has a mind and a plan and is like after us. I mean, obviously, I know this is not true, but when you see one block that's been affected and everything else has been left alone, it does feel almost like a tornado with a vengeance.
There's a lot of speculation about supernatural effects of it, and as you see them make odd left turns or right turns, which the right turns are very uncommon. We had some storm chasers killed in Oklahoma when one made a right turn. There is a sense that there's some supernatural effect on things. And it is just, it's that randomness of it. I've seen them come up. I watched one wipe out a farm that I had just visited like 3 days before. And the sense of here 1 second and gone the next. And yeah, the media does, if there's one block impacted, they will find the worst damage. They've got a natural attraction to that, and they'll focus on that. And sadly, A lot of times they want to have that one fatality so they can hang the deadly tornado on it. But not to, to minimize the loss of life, but lives are destroyed. For the survivors, it's also very devastating.
Russ, this kind of brings us back to the themes we've touched on, especially power versus powerlessness.
And fear. You know, you were talking about all of the different things in The Wizard of Oz that can generate fear. And you start thinking about it, and there's a lot. And why is that okay for kids? Well, I think it's okay because children have to learn how to get over those fears. And if they are scared of tornadoes, I think it's generally a good idea. The more they know about it, the better.
Clint, so much of the Oz Museum in Wamego has to do with the staying power of The Wizard of Oz. Spinoffs, interpretations, references, merchandise that's come out over the years. It's really like a pop culture critique in a way. I mean, on some level, this museum, I would say. Do you think that's fair?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think that part of that staying power has to do with that fear component? We don't usually think of fear as something that is spun off and merchandised. And
well, I think that the fear provides something compelling about the story. There has to be challenges that need to be overcome, and they need to be challenges that we can feel. But I think one of the reasons it's so popular is because Dorothy is faced with these challenges that many of us fear, and she overcomes them.
Like what?
Well, the tornado is a great example. She survived it, and back at that time, there was a larger death toll before we had the practices that we have in place now. Facing that evil woman that even was scaring, the equivalent was scaring her aunt and uncle, and walking through life, meeting these daily challenges and figuring out a path and working together with others to solve these problems.
Let's hear from Mary in Kansas City. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What can you tell us about how The Wizard of Oz has affected you as someone in this area?
Well, as a traveler, I've traveled and I engage in conversations with people, and just the one story that stands out the most, traveling back and forth to the East Coast from Kansas City, I met a young man on the plane who just had his backpack, and he said, "I'm coming to Kansas because I just want to come and see it for myself." And just the whole perception, when you tell someone that you're from Kansas City, they automatically think Kansas. And it kind of is a little stick in my craw sometimes because I live in Missouri. And I was in the entertainment business, and at the Apollo back then, in the 80s, and Ralph Cooper at the time with the Showtime and the Apollo thing, and he would announce, before the person would come out on stage, and I just, he would always say Kansas when I say I'm from Kansas City, and on this one big date when CBS was filming and everything was happening, and he announced all the way from Kansas. And before I came out on the stage, and I just thought, man, I'm from Missouri. It's not Kansas, because all they think are wheat fields and all that kind of thing. So
do you have a little bit of the feeling of that previous caller, that maybe you're from Missouri and that maybe you're more from Oz than Kansas?
Well, they always think Oz. Everybody that I've ever met across the world where I've traveled, whether it's on the East Coast or abroad, when you say from Kansas City, they just get this picture in their mind.
Well, we have to take one more break this morning. Great stories from Mary in Kansas City. When we return, a local costume designer weighs in. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to Central Standard on KCUR. We're back. This is A Screen Time, all about The Wizard of Oz on KCUR's Central Standard. We've been hearing from a tornado expert, a film critic, and the director of the Oz Museum in Wamego, Kansas. Now let's talk quickly with the local costume designer whose work is everywhere in Kansas City theaters. Georgiana Landre is with us now. Hi, Georgiana.
Hello.
Tell me about the the costumes in The Wizard of Oz are so iconic. Dorothy's gingham dress, the ruby slippers. You say the words ruby slippers and you cannot be talking about anything but The Wizard of Oz. And it's as we've pointed out, it's been almost 80 years. What do you think was so powerful about the costume design?
Well, the costume design is really one of the greatest film costume designs in Hollywood history, I think. And the pieces from that movie have been auctioned for incredible sums of money, probably the largest sums of money from any collection of Hollywood memorabilia. But the ruby slippers were really Adrian, who is the costume designer for the film, his design, because they wanted the ruby slippers to show up better in Technicolor, which was the new process they were working on that really separated the Kansas world from the fantasy world of Oz. And it's a very big deal in the movie, of course. And so although L. Frank Baum wrote that the slippers were silver in the book, they thought it would be more exciting to have red ruby slippers.
What can you tell us about sort of the goal of effective costume design and how you were saying that this is one of the greatest costume design achievements in film history? Like, what is it that good costume design does, and how does The Wizard of Oz do it?
Well, I think Adrian was very interested in creating characters and making sure that he honored the character. So he designed the blue and white gingham dress. It is based on the fact that in the book she put on a fresh dress in order to start down the yellow brick road. But he designed that costume trying to make Judy Garland appear as young as possible. They went through several screen tests of how she should look, how to do the hair, everything. But there's something about these costumes that, not only because of repeated viewing and we just really think of Oz in those visual terms, the designs were incredible. I mean, he did over 1,000 costumes with 3,000 hand-painted renderings, and all of them were custom built, including the munchkins that were all made out of felt. And he had ideas behind wanting the men's munchkins to look like part of their environment, with hundreds of flowers and vines. And he wanted the residents of the Emerald City to look like toy soldiers, and they're all really carefully done.
Do you think that the story would have had the staying power if not for all of this thought into costume design? Because we're used to thinking about, you know, what is it that really sticks with us in terms of dialogue, in terms of acting, and in terms of all these other aspects of cinema. But yeah, I mean, if you talk about Dorothy, it's going to be just minutes, if not seconds, before ruby slippers come up. And I think it's rare for a film to have such a costume memory cue.
It's true. It's really an amazing thing. Of course, a simple farm girl would never have ruby slippers. So the idea of possessing this power and not really knowing how to use it, of course, she had the power to go home the whole time, but that was something fantastical. And she really was a pretty practical and plucky girl on her adventure and got through a lot of nonsense. But to have this sort of glamour put on top of the simple farm girl was really kind of novel. And so her adventure is just, you know, pure fantasy, but she's ultimately a pretty good steward of her adventure and just getting the job done.
Well, thanks so much, Georgiana, for shedding light on that, because yeah, it's just an awesome thing to think about these symbols that capture so much that are also, yeah, costume.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks. We have just a little time left for this discussion about The Wizard of Oz, and we've been hearing so much about how Kansas comes across really unfavorably by comparison to Oz. But in some way, the word Kansas is stated over and over again in this most watched movie. And, you know, they say that no publicity is bad publicity. What do you think, Clint Stevie?
No, I would agree. I think that based on the callers and my own experiences in my travels, that The Wizard of Oz is probably one of the biggest marketing pieces Kansas has. Not that we don't have many things that we can claim, but this piece that's been identified with Kansas for over 100 years has the marketing power behind it that, say, would be on par with Coca-Cola. And we lay claim to for the most known characters in American literature, you know, Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Lion, the Tin Man. Kansas can lay claim to those. Those are great mascots for our state. I think that whether you love it or hate it, this has really put Kansas on the map. You think if you go to a foreign country, one of the few states they can name is Kansas, you know, so I think that's a unique feature that we're seeing from this.
And Steve, Kansas has an interesting relationship with marketing and tornadoes overall. I mean, the tornado is not part of some intentional marketing scheme on the part of the state of Kansas, but with what Clint has just said, the tornado is part of that message going out about Kansas.
Well, it is. I mean, it's the dead center in Tornado Alley. And I alluded earlier, they had warning systems proposed as far back as the 1880s. And up until the mid-1950s, business people and land developers did not want the government to issue tornado warnings or predict tornadoes because they were afraid it would drive people away, would keep people from settling in Tornado Alley. And I find it interesting that in fact, that tornado reference is probably the thing that has drawn a lot of people to the state, or at least made them aware of Kansas to go look it up. And I believe there was a time, they may still do it, where they had Land of Oz was the logo, the slogan they were doing. I may be dating myself.
For the state of Kansas?
Yeah, for the state of Kansas. For a period, license plates said Land of AHS or something they called it.
Oh, yeah. That is ringing a bell. Well, and the marketing around the movie itself is a huge part of what's at the Oz Museum.
Yes. You know, it's because it's one of the most recognizable pieces of media coming from the United States, it's been very easy for a lot of companies to latch on to that, to be identified with it, to help them sell their own products. So this goes across the board, t-shirts, peanut butter, you name it. Somebody has thought, if I put Oz on this, this is going to help me sell it, including the state of Kansas.
And in the museum, you start, do I remember correctly that you start in a lobby that's sepia toned?
Yes, everybody starts out in Aunt Em's gift shop, which is all sepia tone. It's painted to be like the landscape that you see in the Kansas scenes by a local painter, Cynthia Martin. And we have barns that showcase the pieces that are available for purchase. And you go up to the house to purchase your tickets, go through the museum. And so once you get out of that, you then open the door and you're in Technicolor and you follow Dorothy's journey through Oz. And you're highlighting some of the pieces that are on display as well.
So. Does anything from The Wizard of Oz scare you?
No, not at the moment.
I was just wondering because I was thinking you, if so, you had a lot of confronting your fears to do at work every day.
That is a challenge for some of our staff.
Well, that's all the time we have for this Screen Time episode all about The Wizard of Oz. Steve Bean with Kansas City's Office for Emergency Management, thanks for the tornado expertise.
Thank you for having me.
And Clint Stevie, it's been awesome having you. Have a safe drive back to the Oz Museum in Wamego. I'm glad you're not scared of anything.
Thank you.
Russ Simmons, as always, a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Russ is Central Standard's resident film critic. You can listen back to our discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you by the end of the day. And don't forget, we deliver this show in podcast form, too. You can sign up while you're there, kcur.org/centralstandard. And speaking of podcasts, KCUR's next podcast party is at the Buffalo Room next Thursday. Check it out. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with Fridays Like Today by Jen Chen. We get lots of help from interns Chloe Duggar and Glenn Frizzell. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.